You're watching Network Radio. Live from the Media Broadcasting Center.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade.
It looks like one of those scenes of an old building being purposely dynamited and blown.
When we are successful,
I'm just a patsy.
And we will be.
You ready to make to come to the microphone, so we'll listen up.
A new world order.
My name's Robbie Parker.
It might have appeared that way, but from my close-up inspection, there's no evidence of a plane having crashed anywhere near the Pentagon.
Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories concerning the attacks of September the 11th.
President Kennedy died at 1 p.m.
Live from the Media Broadcasting Center. This
is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, where I have an extraordinary program for you this evening. A couple who spent years in Libya, who knows what know what happened and can give you the truth, the story behind the story, exposing Hillary Clinton as a major big-time liar about the political sequence of events there, which in my opinion even has the potential to derail her presidential aspirations. They are James, Jimmy, and Joanne Moriarty, and I'm so pleased to have you here. Jimmy and Joanne, please introduce yourselves and tell us how you got into the middle of all this.
Thank you, Jim, for having us on your show. We're proud to be your guest tonight.
Thank you so much, Jim. We're real happy to be here.
Tell us how you first got into Libya, your background and so forth that led you to be in the position you wound up being in.
Okay, first of all, we're not political at all. We're business folks. We own a proprietary technology that rejuvenates oil wells and cleans up pipeline and sludge pits and chicken fat and all kinds of things like that. And since Libya had been precluded from any modern technologies for almost 40 years, we targeted Libya as a new market for us. And we went into Libya the first time, January 1st, 2007, shortly after the treaty was signed between Condoleezza Rice and Gaddafi. And from 2007 till 2011, we were in Libya 17 times. We were there never less than 30 days, sometimes as much as 90 days. We traveled all over Libya. We garnered almost $5 billion worth of contracts for our products. We signed a contract, actually the first trip in there, which nobody ever does. It's always 2 or 3 years in a country like that before you get a contract. First trip in, we got a contract. And we then began to look for a Libyan partner. And Libya was such a closed society. It was so foreign to all of us, even though we're internationally astute, if you would. Very, very closed society, tribal, nice people, polite people, very friendly people. They were so happy to see us from the United States, you know. But it took us until first week in January 2011, that's when I signed a joint venture contract with the Social Security Fund of John Zuer. That was about a $16 billion Social Security Fund, and the beneficiaries of that Social Security Fund were all the oil field executives and service companies and everything. So we had a perfect entree into all the oil and gas companies with them. The first week in February, I signed the contract to locate our new production facility in a new free port that was being built near the border of Tunisia. And I actually left on the 8th of February. Within about 15 days, the false flag operation to take over Libya started. And, you know, the thing that was really hard for us to imagine beginning with our first trip in there was just how much better Libya was than what we knew. And anything your audience has heard about Libya absolutely was not correct. And to give you some idea about what Libya really was, when a new couple got married, the government gifted them $47,000. Every new baby got $5,000 gift from the government. Their first
one slide, the first slide, maybe.
Okay.
Let's try the first slide.
I think it may be up.
Okay, then maybe the second slide.
Okay.
The your first car cost you half a dealer invoice. Your home and the government was, at the time we were there, they were building 620,000 new condominiums. 2,000 square foot was the smallest. 10% of your salary for 10-year paid for it. Your utilities were free. Gasoline was 44 cents a gallon. Hospitalization was paid. And if you couldn't get the treatment in Libya, then the government paid for you to travel with a family member, paid all your travel expenses and all the hospital expenses for you to go anywhere in the world to get the treatment you needed. Education was fully paid. Again, if your brain would support it, they would pay you plus a stipend to live on to study anywhere. We know a young man getting his doctorate in England. He had a wife and four kids. His monthly stipend was 1,750 pounds.
Jimmy, you're talking about a government that's actually functioning to benefit the people.
Oh, yeah.
This is unheard of.
Yeah. The government used 49% of their income to run the government. The rest of the money was distributed out to help the people. Nobody in Libya had any debt. The country of Libya didn't have any debt. Libya had $241 billion in cash and cash equivalents in the Federal Reserve System. They had $150 billion in cash equivalents in Euroclear. They had 179 tons of gold, 2,000 tons of silver, lots of tons of other heavy earths and precious earths. If you were a bad businessman and you lost your money and your family needed food, you could go to warehouses, storehouses all over the country without any ID or anything, say, I need food. They would give you 50 kilos of rice, 50 kilos of flour, sugar, salt, cheese, and enough money to have an animal slaughtered for your family. And if you went back tomorrow and did it again, that was okay.
Wow.
It was not like anything you'd ever heard. And women there, Joanne will tell you about the life of women in Libya.
I think we need to, I just want to talk about these slides for a minute. The slides are not in the order we're talking, so just go back to the first slide first. And then we'll
right, I was going to suggest that too.
Yeah.
Chance, back to the first slide. Yeah.
That's fine. In Libya, women were emancipated in 1970s by Gaddafi. Gaddafi was anti-radical Islam, anti all the stuff that the radical Islams believe. He did not believe in Sharia law. He did not believe in any of that stuff. In fact, he encouraged women not to even wear the hijab, the headscarf. He didn't even like that. For that, there was a fatwa put on him for 20 years by the radical Islamists in Iran and some other places. They wanted to kill him for 20 years because of that. What most people don't understand is Libya was the poorest country in Africa in the 19th, forever. It was occupied by foreign countries for most of its history. It's got an 8,000-year-old history. It was being occupied by Italy in the 1960s, and then they put in the old despot king, which Libya never had a king ever. That was a puppet put in there by the UK and the US and oil companies to control the oil. He was a pedophile. He was he was not a good man. He was not a smart man. And the tribes got together and they threw him out. And it was a bloodless coup. He just left because he knew he was a bad guy. The tribes, the 11 main tribes, appointed Gaddafi as the head because he was the highest educated, and he was the man that
he was
very charismatic and he was smart. From that point forward, from 1969, when the Al-Fatah Revolution happened, till 2011, when Hillary Clinton and her minions and her proxy army went in and illegally blew up that country, Libya went from the poorest country to the most developed country in Africa.
The most prosperous.
Richest country, yes. The most prosperous country in Africa.
They went from 60 dinar a year in salary to the highest income in Africa at $15,700 a year. That was higher than China, higher than India. And if you graduated from university and you couldn't find a job, the government supported you at $15,500 a year until you got a job. And,
actually a kind of paradise for a human being.
Yeah, it was. It was a very nice country. Yeah. They didn't even have any, in Tripoli of 2 million people, there were maybe 5 policemen. They just stood around in white uniforms. They didn't even have any guns.
Listen, when we went in there the first trip, I had 4 security men with us. Great big guys that would block out the sun. They would fill up a door. Well-trained security people. One to travel with us on each corner, you know. After 2 days, I sent them home. We walked freely around the city of Tripoli without fear of anything. People stopped us on the street. They smiled. They were happy to see us. You know, this is not the Libya that was described by all the media. And, you know, we found out later on that the Lockerbie situation was forced on Libya. Libya was not guilty of that. And the FBI and the CIA have confirmed that that was a false flag operation, that Gaddafi had to claim that in order to be allowed back into the world, community, you know. Libya was also not guilty for the bombing of that discotheque, not guilty of killing the policeman in England. All those things have been proven and outed by, CIA people.
In fact,
they were concocted to demonize him, to be used.
That's right. Because Libya was a naive country. They didn't feel that they had to defend themselves. They were, you know, the Libyan people never even owned their own country until the Al-Fatah revolution, until 1969. At that time, Gaddafi gave all the land to the people who were working it.
First time they'd own their own land
in their thousands of year history. There might have been a couple wealthy Libyans who owned land, but not the people. Nobody in Libya owned any land. So it, for him, what he did for Libya, he was their leader, whether he was in charge of the government or not. He was not in charge of the government in 2011 when John McCain and Hillary Clinton and all Barack Obama were saying he was attacking his people. It wasn't Gaddafi wasn't even in charge. In 2006, when he was signed the treaty with Condoleezza Rice to open Libya to the world market, he was required to step down. And he did. He was not in charge. They had a prime minister and they had two parliaments. They had the elected people's house, and then they had the tribal leaders, the general secretary of the tribes. Ran the country.
But when he was required to step down, Libya was required to give up half of its military force. It was required to stop all enrichment of uranium and its nuclear activities. It agreed to all those things and did all those things. In fact, Chris Stevens was part of the UN task force in there that saw the reduction and removal of all the enriched uranium and nuclear program of Libya. But the thing that was surprising to us is, and we never met Gaddafi, but we got to know Gaddafi because the people really liked him. Now, was Libya a perfect country? No, they had real trouble. And the real trouble stemmed from Misrata. And about 150 years ago, Karjite Jews from Turkey, not really Jews, but Karjites, and I want everybody to understand
Zionists.
There's a difference. They took over Misrata, feigned conversion to Islam, but they still had their mosques and, I mean, their temples and gun-making facilities underground in Misrata, and they were the mafia. They were the bad guys, and they would fight anybody. Libyans are the most non-confrontational people you will ever meet in your life. They won't fight about anything. And the Misrata mafia would fight about everything. So consequently, they got 60% of all the contracts in Libya without bid or tender. The other 40% were let by bid or tender. Those 60% that they were gifted, they then turn around and leverage those out to foreign contractors, and then constantly screwed the contractor on short payments and any changes in the contract. Those change orders were paid to the mafia, but not to the builders, not the contractors. So consequently, Libya had about 150 major projects that were abandoned. Thank you very much, Misrata. And Misrata had stolen, the last sin they did was about $100 billion they had stolen from Libya via a Barney Madoff kind of a scheme. And some bright young men in the Libyan IT area found it, discovered it, and the government of Libya was going after Misrata. They were going to reclaim all their properties, all their companies and everything. And that's the group that joined hands with the CIA to go in and overthrow Libya. So that's the Zionists.
Chance, we got some funny Chrome survey showing up here. Maybe it's only on my screen, but I think it's on yours.
I see it.
Can you check that, Chance, do a refresh or something?
Okay. And so, you know, that was the problem in Libya. That was really the biggest political problem. And we had a personal experience with those guys. As I said, we garnered almost $5 billion worth of contracts, And we originally, the only free zone that was big enough to for us to locate our new production plant, large scale enzyme production plant, was actually in Misrata. We went there, we met with them, we signed pre-agreements. Next thing we knew, they came after us to try to take all our contracts. They wanted to put Joanne and myself in jail, and they wanted to force us to give them our technology. And we actually went to court over that in Libya. And the courts in Libya upheld our position as the rightful, lawful owners. And they told us that now then the Misrata Mafia owed us whatever amount of money we wanted to claim, because they had cost us months and months and months of delays and money, and that whatever amount we put on it would be paid to us. The government would see that we were paid. And they said, make sure it's some millions of dollars. And I said, you know, we don't want to have to look over our shoulder the rest of our lives. Rather not do that. And they said, no, no, from now on, you will be protected. Anytime anybody looks you in the eye or looks aggressively to you, you come to this police station, you talk to them, they will immediately arrest those people, put them in jail.
Well, Jimmy, I think I would have taken them up on that.
Well, but, you know, we had so much business to do there, and we didn't need.
Yeah, yeah, money. Yeah. But just tell them $10 million will do it fine. And then, you know, you're locked into the system.
That's true. But, you know, the thing that the tribal system, and I want everybody to really appreciate this. Here's how it works. If, let's say I run into your car, you're going to immediately forgive me for the accident. And then I'm going to owe you a favor that you can call anytime in the future. And next year, your daughter's going to get married. And you say, you know what? I'd like you to provide all the food for the banquet after the wedding. I'm required to do that. And if I don't do it, then my family must do it. And if my family doesn't do it, then my tribe must do it. And
that's,
if you and I
love it. I love it.
And if you and I can't come to that agreement on the spot, then they take you and myself and put us in jail in the same cell, and they feed us gruel and camel's milk until we can come to that agreement. That's their system. So it's based on humanity. It's based on forgiveness.
It's
and everybody,
thousands of years
you know, old. Mistakes can be made, but you have to claim responsibility for your errors.
This is a wonderful culture.
No idea.
This is the most this is the most humane culture I've ever heard described in my life.
Yeah, well, the culture of Libya, when this war was going on, I said the greatest threat to Libya is the death of their wonderful culture that's been 8,000 years going on. You know, it's going to be destroyed because half of the people, or almost half of them, live in exile now. They killed 600,000 of them. So, you know, it's something that they would really like to destroy. They want to make Libya a new country filled with their neocons or ISIS or whoever.
And they are destroyed by a combination of NATO and mercenaries?
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Libyan Gaddafi never fired on his people. Ever. The three shootists, the killed people in Benghazi have been proven to be from Qatar. They were marksmen from Qatar. And of course the media said immediately that was Gaddafi shooting his people. Not true. And the next thing, on the first day of the quote unquote revolution, within an hour of each other, 18 police stations were firebombed. They stole cars, made firebombs out of them, drove them into the front of the police station, and then raided those police stations and took all the guns and ammunition, everything out. And then they started an attack all over Libya. This was no peaceful revolution. It was a timed, planned attack of that country. These same guys then, coincidental to this happening.
Clearly orchestrated when you have
Blackwater, CIA, MI5.
Coincidental to this happening, bulldozers with a special prong in the front knocked down the walls opposite where the tanks were kept. They had a special grappling hook. They dragged the cannon out, turned the barrel around, started firing on the military compound. And while all this is going on, Gaddafi and the other leaders are saying, please stop this fighting. We don't know what you want, but, you know, whatever it is, you know, you can have it. We don't want the people killed. And that was the mantra of the Libyans during the entire war. And they were the Libyan people did not want a part of this. There were about 3 to 5% radicals in Libya. But the UN, US, and NATO brought in 250,000 mercenaries, armed them, trained them, and continue to this day to finance them and provide them with weapons because nobody in Libya wanted this.
I'm very troubled by the role of the UN here. It suggests to me it's just as corrupt as that of the United States and NATO.
Absolutely. Go listen to Paul Craig Roberts. UN is operated by the Zionists. 100%. No, the UN was as culpable as anybody. And not only that, the resolution.
It was the League of Nations first. I mean, it might as well be the Council on Foreign Relations. It's absolutely a corrupt organization.
The first thing that everybody should realize is that the only thing that was ever resolved was a no-fly zone. And after 2.5 days, the U.S. pilots that set up that no-fly zone said it was so successful, Libya couldn't put a mosquito in the air. So why then, after the no-fly zone was established, and that was all that was authorized, why then did the U.S., UN, and NATO conduct 60,000 bombing sorties into Libya? They had more bombing raids into Libya than World War II combined. The people did not want a part of it, and they continued to bomb them into oblivion.
They bombed their houses. They bombed their food supplies. They embargoed their food supplies to Tripoli. Their food, their water, their medical supplies were embargoed. These are war crimes, international war crimes.
They bombed water treatment plants. They bombed power plants.
They bombed
refineries.
These are all war crimes you're describing.
Huge war crimes. Yeah.
They bombed all the agricultural areas of Libya. They started genocide against blacks the first week of this. And what happened to us, like I said, I left there the 8th of February. And within days of getting back here, the Libyans were calling us because we had gotten to know them over those last 5 or 6 years. And they said, you know, there are these people coming into Libya because Libya had open borders to any Arab, any Muslim. They said, these people are coming, flowing into this country like crazy, and they're not normal people. They're real hard people. They're bearded, you know, and they have funny dialects, and they don't have clothes like anybody from around here. Well, they were coming from Afghanistan and Yemen and all over, you know.
Yeah.
And, then a few weeks later, they said, these people are so bad, you know, any piece of military hardware that doesn't work, they can pick it up and make it work. And they have advisors and people with them from foreign countries that don't even speak Arabic and are helping them. And they have money. They're trying to bribe all our young men to go fight with them.
You're talking about the looting of Libya.
Oh, sure. 100%. We have videos of U.S. either special forces or Blackwater. We have videos of them showing them how to shoot guns.
I'll give you another interesting fact. First time in the history of the world that a bunch of revolutionaries go into a country, start making a turmoil, making a mess, and that week a central bank was opened and authorized and recognized by the Federal Reserve and Euroclear, by the Zionist bankers, the first week of this supposed revolt, and immediately $1 billion was transferred into that bank through Saudi Arabia. That money was released in cash to the mercenaries to pay all the monies to their people. Immediately, all the money of Libya, and as I said earlier, it amounted to more than $500 billion. That money disappeared. It has still disappeared. All the gold and silver and everything was taken out of Russia. Where did it go?
Out
of Libya, pardon me. So, you know, the economic event was really bad. Here is a country, not a very big population, 6.5 million people, big footprint, lots and lots of wealth, in situ, money, gold, silver, et cetera. And so the Zionists looked at it and said, hell, we can go blow this place up and make them pay for it with their own money and come out several $100 billion to the good. And that's exactly what they did.
Astounding.
It's sickening. It's sickening.
Completely deplorable. Just grotesque.
Now then, I'm going to tell you how we ended up in Libya during the war because, you know, we're not nuts. But we had this huge amount of business booked. We had just moved all our production and marketing facilities into Libya. And we were contacted in April by an international peace organization, 2 billion members worldwide, and asked us
youth organization.
If we would head an NGO fact-finding commission. We didn't know what that was, but we said, you know, if we can help try to affect the truth out of Libya, really first reason to get our business going again. We said, sure, but we wanted to have unfettered access to any part of Libya, because what we'd been hearing on the news was not the Libya we knew. And we said, we want to go see and we want to talk to people and find out if Gaddafi really fired on them, if they used explosive warheads, if they used depleted uranium, cluster bombs. We really wanted to know that. And they said, you can do whatever you want. So we went there. Our first trip in was for 5 days, and they asked us if we would stay longer. We went out for 1 day and came back in. And then we ended up being trapped inside Tripoli because you could not get into Libya because of no-fly zone except by land. So we had to fly into Djerba.
Tunisia,
and then come by land all the way into Tripoli, and that's a long drive. And when we came in the second time, they began to fight in the Sibrata area, and that road to Tunisia was no longer safe to travel on. So we were actually trapped inside Tripoli for 100 days. Now, from Tripoli, we would take trips out into the country. We went to areas where genocide had been conducted on blacks. We saw
What was the point of that? What was the genocide on blacks? What was that all about?
Well, that's the Zionists always want to kill the blacks. They commit black genocide every chance they can.
The leaders of Al-Qaeda, which was that was what the radical Islamists, their proxy army was called at that time, was Al-Qaeda. A lot of those guys were fighting against us in Afghanistan, and we joined hands with them and brought them into Libya. Because there were no Libyans that wanted to join this fight, so they took the 4% that were radicals and they released everybody out of prisons in Libya immediately. They opened all the prisons and let all the psychopaths out. Because Libya, radical Islam was not welcome in Libya. If you came there, you were a radical, or you were born there and became a radical, you either had to leave or you went to prison.
If you had a beard like me, you would not be advanced in your company.
Well, you might not even get into Libya. When we were going there, people with beards weren't even welcome there. Muslim people. It didn't matter for us. They knew we weren't Muslims. But the interesting thing is that Al-Qaeda, the leader of this Al-Qaeda, his name's Hasidi, he was interviewed by the Telegraph in Libya, their newspaper. And he said, America's 50-50 now because they're fighting with us, with our cause, and they're arming us and helping us. As long as they do that, they're okay. They're just okay. He admitted that he was working with the CIA, with Obama administration. He was being funded by them. He was brought into Libya to lead these groups that were brought into Libya, the proxy armies, to take over Libya.
The week before, he'd been killing American soldiers in Afghanistan. And the terrible thing is the United States installed all these no-goodniks as leaders of that country. And they're not even Libyans.
Most of them are not even Libyan citizens.
And something else I want your folks to understand is I don't care what name you hear. Al-Qaeda, Muslim Brotherhood, Ansar al-Sharia, al-Nusra, ISIS, they're all the same. They switch the names around to keep us confused because the media attacks. They grab onto the new name and, oh, my goodness. No, it's the same ones. And they change the name and they change the name. And so we think it's another group. No, it's all the same ones. And MI6, Mossad, and CIA have organized and trained and continue to fund and train and supply these radical terrorists.
And
they're not Islam. They're not the Muslims don't claim them. They say these are not Muslims. These guys have nothing to do with our religion.
They just co-opted the religion to use it as a reason for what they do.
Now then, why would the powers that be go after Libya? I'm going to give you the three reasons. First of all, Gaddafi, after he resigned from office, he had a fertile mind and he formulated the African Bank because he saw what the Zionist bankers did worldwide. And he said he didn't think anybody should be a part of that. And Africa would never be able to be developed unless it got out of that Babylonian, criminal financial scheme. So he organized the African Bank, which was a gold backed currency for the continent of Africa. It was domiciled in its head office in the Comore Islands. All the Arab countries had signed up as members, and half of Africa had signed up. And a gold-backed currency with all the natural resources of Africa would have put the Zionist toilet paper bankers out of business.
The gold dinar.
You got it. And the toilet paper bankers could not have that. So they had to eliminate that. So they wanted to kill Gaddafi and wipe forever any idea of that happening. Second, United States is bound and determined to have a war with China one day, and they wanted to preclude China from having access to the riches of Africa. So the United States, of course, formed AFRICOM, and that was the military control of Africa by the U.S. Libya said not only no, but hell no. South Africa said no, hell no, and six other countries. So in order to make AFRICOM a reality, knock off the most powerful, most productive country, and then the rest of them would fall. So knock off Libya. The U.S. wanted to be involved in that to eliminate Libya and thereby cause AFRICOM to work. Third, Gaddafi had he was always an African Union guy, and he'd seen all the treaties that were broken by all the imperialists that had come into Africa. And so he organized a class action suit of all these broken treaties against the perpetrators. And this included France and England and Germany and all these countries that had been into Africa. He also included the United States, because the 38 years of sanctions were not only illegal and unwarranted, but they caused a lot of financial damage to Libya. So they went to world court. He did. Class action suit, $7 trillion. And the attorney said that lawsuit had legs. So, of course, immediately France and England, all the rest of them said, hell, we want to be a part of that. We want to eliminate that probability, because they were all in the toilet. Their financial systems were. And they couldn't afford to pay out 50 cents, much less $7 trillion. So they joined hands. That's why you had this coalition of criminals that wanted to completely eliminate Libya. And it wasn't enough just to dispose Gaddafi, who had already stepped down, but they had to eliminate any possible spark of that country ever coming back into any kind of strength, because it was such a glowing light for the world.
You know, there was a meeting of the Gaddafi family. I don't know if you remember this, but during the 2011 war, in probably in March or April, in the first part of it, there was a time when Saif Gaddafi, his son, came out and was very angry, and he said, all these rebels are going to die, we're going to kill you all, and he said a bunch of stuff that really shouldn't have said, probably, but he was very angry. And the reason he was angry was because there'd been a private meeting in Juba, mm-hmm, with the Gaddafi family, with the French CIA or whatever their private, or their
Securité,
the CIA, the MI5, the Mossad, had a meeting with Gaddafi, and he said, what do you want? Whatever you want, you can have it. I will leave the country. My family will leave the country. You can take it. Take the oil, whatever you want. Please just stop killing the Libyan people. Stop bombing our country. And they looked at him and said, not a chance. We're going to destroy your country because we want to, and you're going to die because we said you're going to die, and there's nothing you can do about it.
You and your family.
You and your family are going to die. This is why he was safe, was so angry. He'd been in that meeting.
This is so disgusting.
Oh, it is beyond disgusting, because here is a man. All he wanted to do was lead his people. That's all he wanted to do.
I'm going to tell you another interesting fact. We got to know several ambassadors while we were trapped in Tripoli. And one of them, Maxim Maximov, he was the new ambassador from Russia. And, when he came in there, his staff called us and said, would you meet with the Russian ambassador? And we said, sure, why not? So he came to our hotel, and he said, this is kind of a funny position for us. He said, we call the Libyan government to find out what the truth is, because we see one thing on the media and we see another thing. We're hearing another thing here in Libya. And the government said, if you want to know what's really going on in Libya, go talk to these two Americans, because they know soldiers that are coming back from the field. They know more about Libya than anybody.
We went to all the tribal meetings.
So he came and met with us, and he wanted to know what was going on and why and how. So we had a long, nice visit with him, you know. And we were interested kind of in getting to know them, because that's one of the few places in Libya you could get an adult beverage. And so, you know, you have to kind of make those inroads as you can. And I asked him, I said, you know, why in the world has Russia not stepped in to stop this? Russia had a huge investment in a railroad that they were putting across Libya, actually to get to a big iron ore resource there, and they joined hands with China. And he said because Libya has the ability to stop all this bombing, they have the most sophisticated defense systems in the world. Not offensive, defensive. We know because we sold them to them. And Gaddafi has elected not to use them because Gaddafi says if we try to defend ourselves, then the U.S., U.N., and NATO will come in here and destroy all my people. And he said, so they've elected not to use them.
But they were going to destroy them anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah, but, you know, the Libyans had their hope.
But besides that, Medvedev was the president at that time, and he's a good friend of Obama's.
Yeah.
So he would not step up and help Libya. If Putin had been in, it would have been a different story. That it would have been like Syria.
Let me tell you something. Libyan people are faithful people. Until Tripoli was overrun, they all said, the truth and our God will protect us. And we were telling them, not when you've got this great big gorilla attacking you. You have to come out and tell your story. They wouldn't do it. They really said, no, you know, our God will protect us. And real sad, sad, sad thing, because they never really had a chance to defend themselves. And they were blown up because of it. The mass graves, we saw about 20 ourselves. There are 128 mass graves in Libya full of black bodies.
Well, black and Arab bodies.
But mostly black.
Well, there's a lot of
and
Arabs.
And we came to the United States when we finally got back, and we tried.
And those were black Africans.
Yeah. They're Libyans.
30% of Libya are black.
Libya, legitimate Libyans with Libyan passports, 30% of them are black. Had been for
Why should anyone care what color they are?
Libya was colorblind.
This has to do with the radical Islamists. They said when they came in there, they made a statement, and I have actually the newspaper report that says, we will cleanse Libya of this black plague, or whatever he called it. We will clean them, period.
But it was just all the scourge was somewhere of darker complexion.
That's true. Right. That's exactly right. But, and it was so disgusting, we couldn't even believe it.
Everybody here, Farrakhan and every black leader in the United States, Al Sharpton, every one of them you want to talk about, Jesse Jackson, Al Sharpton, all of them, we contacted them and said, you know, you need to help the Libyans. The blacks in Libya are specifically being targeted. Anytime a group of Libyan soldiers were caught, if they were beige, they were shot in the head. If they were black, they were chopped up. And I'm going to go back to the first day of the revolution, quote unquote. There was a group of, I think, 17 or 18 military that had been trying to defend the Benghazi airport. And they kept having wave after wave of these guys, and they were told to shoot at the ground in front of them, shoot over their head. Don't kill any of them. You know, they're your brothers. They're just misguided. And finally, the numbers kept mounting so big that they were given the instruction by Gaddafi's son to abandon their posts and travel back to their homes because the Libyans, the authorities in Libya couldn't figure out what was going on. And so these people were migrating back. They ended up in Al Baida City, and they didn't know it at the time, but Al Baida City was a hotbed of radicals. And so they were told that they were in good hands. They'd be safe. They'd keep them away from the rebels. But in order to disguise themselves, they need to take their military uniforms off. They need to put on their civilian uniforms. They need to have their hands tied behind them, so it made them look like they were captives. And then they'd be
hands driven. Tied behind them. Oh my!
Yeah.
God.
Yeah.
It turns out
about the lamb to the slaughter.
Oh, it's worse than that. Al Jazeera and Al Arabiya were embedded with the rebels from the first day. And these two newscasters, these new groups with their video cameras rolling and everything, were filming all this. And they took them to a mosque. They had a kangaroo court, ended up declaring that these guys had fired on a civilian car. They didn't know anything about it. They were taken outside, and they were all executed. The blacks were chopped up. The beige guys were shot. One of the young black men had his head cut off.
They said Gaddafi did this.
Yeah.
To the
this is what Al Jazeera and Al Arabiya, they kept putting this out. Gaddafi did this to the civilians.
Complete false flag.
These are military. The reason we know this is after they killed all these people and chopped them up, they threw their bodies in the back of a truck and they were driving it out in the desert to get rid of them. And at one stop, somebody standing on the side of the road saw a body moving. So they made the truck stop. They took this body out. This one guy had two bullets in his head and one in his shoulder. He was still alive. In a coma, but he was alive. They took him to a hospital in Benghazi. They removed the first bullet there. The second bullet was so deep they couldn't remove the bullet from his skull. So they planned to get him in shape so they could move him to Tunisia and get the medical care he needed. While he was in the hospital, three attempts were made to poison him and kill him. They finally got him to Tunisia. The bullet was removed. He recuperated for some months. And in the middle of the summer, this would have been in like June or July.
He came back. Year 2011 or 11.
It's the middle of the war still.
All right.
His family called us and said, would you please come interview our son? And we had a 2-hour interview with him.
We sat out in the desert under a tree with him.
His speech was very slow, methodical.
We had a translator with us.
And he's the one that told us that Al Jazeera and Al Arabiya, that their cameras, they had that on the side of their cameras. They filmed all this mess of them taking their uniforms off and putting the civilian clothes. They filmed them in the mosque. He said these were newscasters. This is the first day.
They knew they were going to be slaughtered and they were filming it.
This was a few hours.
For propaganda purposes to blame it on Gaddafi.
Exactly.
That's right.
They had visual proof that Gaddafi was killing civilians.
So we have absolute proof of how they started this war and how illegal it was.
That and a couple hundred other gigabytes.
And of course, American politicians were citing all this as justification for using NATO to attack them.
Yes, sir. Sure.
Yes,
yeah.
Sir.
Uh-huh.
People like John McCain and Hillary Clinton, among others.
Yeah, that's right.
That proof and a couple hundred other gigabytes are why we have been on the kill list of the intelligence agencies, because they want to get the proof that we have so the world won't see it. And we've distributed into a lot of places. We've hidden it, you know, and that proof is positive. That proves that this was a false flag operation. The media was involved in it from day one. And all the reasons that they gave to attack Gaddafi were made up. It was actually everything was on the other foot.
You know, we met an ambassador from South Africa during our stay there this particular time, the time we were there during the war. His name is H.E. Dangor, and he's a plenipotentiary ambassador to South Africa. And he was in the hotel we were in near the end because all of his people, all his staff left, and he had to have meals because he had diabetes. So he was staying in the hotel we were, and we sat with him in the coffee area a couple times. Very nice man. And Jim, we asked him, we said, why is it that South Africa sided with Hillary Clinton and NATO? Because South Africa and Libya were longtime allies and friends, liked each other a lot. And he said, you know, he said, your ambassador, Hillary Clinton, showed up in our country and told us that if we did not back her effort to take over Libya, that we might find some rebels in our backyard. And he said it was like the woman had a closet full of these things. And
Jimmy said,
he said she did. She does. This is what she went to every country in Africa. We know she went to Arab countries. We know she went to Kuwait and gave that threat. This is how all the countries were forced to back her NATO thing was through blackmail.
We have a 30-year friend that's about fourth echelon royal family in Kuwait. And, in the early days of the fighting, we tried to get the Kuwaiti royal family to gift the Jaws of Life equipment to Libya because they really had no ability to help save lives. And when a wall fell over, they were out there with ropes and manpower trying to lift the wall up when there were some people alive underneath. And Jaws of Life has all these life-saving devices. And I asked Sabi, I said, see if your royal family won't make a $10 million donation for these Jaws of Life to be gifted to the Libyan people. Non-military hardware, never could be declared military hardware. And I said, if you can get it, great. If not, we'll help you source it. So he said, see if you can find source on it. So we did. And normally Sabi would be back to us in a couple of days. About 10 days later, I called him again. I said, how about the gift? And he said, well, the royal family decided to make the gift $50 million. And I said, oh, great. I said, they will save so many lives. And I said, how are you handling the equipment? He said, well, we contacted your State Department to find out, what was the proper protocol. And they said, well, Qatar is handling all of these kinds of donations for Libya.
Make
your donation to Qatar.
Yes, of course.
And then Hillary Clinton said, and by the way, while you're at it, you need to join hands with us against Gaddafi. And they said, well, why would we do that? And they said, well, because if you don't, you're going to have rebels again in your backyard. So I know that's her statement. We have two eyewitness reports that gave that to us.
We asked our friend, I said, do the people of Kuwait hate Gaddafi? He said, no. All the people of Kuwait love Gaddafi. They respect him. They have a great like for him. They don't understand why this government would ever do anything like that. So it's blackmail.
Yeah.
She's mafia. She uses mafia tactics.
And, they are so proud of their Libyan model. After Gaddafi was killed, some weeks later, Obama standing up there and he's grinning and he said, this has been such a successful endeavor that we're calling this the Libyan model and we'll be using it for all future events like this. And that is that they would go in, declare a no-fly zone, then bomb the hell out of the country and
set up rebels
for their own purposes.
They did it in the Ukraine. They brought in rebels in the Ukraine and they overthrew that government. That was the Council of Foreign Relations set that one up. McCain was there too. Every time there's anything like this, McCain shows up. He's been in Syria. He was in Egypt. He was in Libya. He was in Tunisia.
If you all want to track this thing, follow Bernard Levy and John McCain. And anytime either one of those guys show up in a country,
there's going to be a revolution
next week. I don't think either one of them know who their father was.
It's repulsive beyond words.
It's terrible. It's absolutely terrible.
Repulse.
John McCain, we've got photos of him, and you can find it on the internet. He's there with his arms around Al-Qaeda and Muslim Brotherhood saying, these are my heroes. These are my brothers. He did it in Libya. He did it in Syria. In Tripoli, he was given an award. He and Lindsey Graham were there at the same time. They gave McCain an award as the hero of the radicals
the guy who gave it to him was Abdel Hakim Belhaj, and Belhaj was in prison in Libya, turned over to Libya by the CIA because he was a radical Islamist terrorist, and they caught him at the airport, I think in Hong Kong or somewhere at one time. They turned him back to Libya and put him in prison. Of course, he was let out and now is one of the leaders in the false government in Tripoli. This is the guy that McCain loves.
And don't anybody think that this isn't continuing. Every day, the United States delivers a plane load of mercenaries and weapons and money into Libya, into Matigi Airport, which is the old U.S. military air base right outside Tripoli. Every day, they're supplying support.
Via Turkey. Turkey.
Yeah, via Turkey and Qatar. But the U.S. is still supporting ISIS, Ansar al-Sharia, Muslim Brotherhood.
It's the Obama administration. The U.S. people would never support this kind of thing. But it's what Obama's doing. Obama's Muslim Brotherhood. And it's his.
Are you convinced Obama himself is a Muslim?
Oh, 100%.
They told us back in 2008.
Before he was ever elected, the Libyans told us he was a Muslim.
This was when he was in Chicago and they said, oh, we're so proud you've got a Muslim leader that is going to be president one day. This was in 2008. We said, who is that? And they said, oh, he's a young senator from Chicago, Barack Obama. And I said, no, he's a Christian. They said, no. In the Muslim religion, you can say that. As long as you're advancing the Islam, then you can say anything to an infidel. It's like telling a lie to a dog.
So this is like at the Talmudic maxim that Jews are entitled to lie to the goyim regardless.
Same thing.
Muslims have the same principle in relation to non-Muslims. Infidel.
Yeah, exactly.
There's some history that's been given out recently about Barack Obama and how he at one time wanted to be an Islamic scholar.
A scholar of Islam.
Yeah. This is when he was in Indonesia, and he had a choice to go to a regular school or an Islamic school, and he begged to go to the Islamic school. There's all kinds of history coming out about him now. It's not going to be told anywhere, But he is absolutely has been and will always be a Muslim. He is a member of the Muslim Brotherhood, which started all this radical stuff. It was started by the Mossad. It was started by MI6. And everything stems out of the Muslim Brotherhood. Everything. So he was put in place to put the Turkish, the Ottoman Empire back in place. That was his original goal, was to rebuild the Ottoman Empire. He and Erdogan are best friends. That was the first call Obama made when he was elected, was to Erdogan. Erdogan thinks he's going to be the Khalifa when the caliphate happens, but Obama thinks he's going to be the Khalifa. And Obama is going about destroying this country and bringing in all these Muslims because at some point there's an iron curtain that's going to come down and this is going to be a Sharia state. This is what Obama's goal is.
Why don't we go to this next slide and let's cover some of the, this is
utterly fascinating. Sure. Go right ahead.
Okay. Go ahead.
Well, this is our contributions to intelligence. What happened to us? We were captured by Al-Qaeda when NATO came in and took over Tripoli because Tripoli didn't fall. Tripoli was not going to fall. So they had to come in and physically attack it. And they began bombing all around it. They bombed day and night. And then they brought in their black helicopters, Apache helicopters, and they just brought them in off the ocean. We were in a hotel where we could see them coming in off the ocean. And they started just their guns, their cannons firing on the people in the street. They killed 1,300 people in an hour. They wounded 5,000 people. They just started to destroy the city.
We were on the 21st floor of the Corinthia Hotel, which is right on the Mediterranean. Beautiful view, great big, nice 6-star hotel. And we could hear them, and then we saw them, and they came in low. We could see two gunships. The third one was about a mile away. We could hear it also. And they came in with their blunt guns blazing, and they killed, like Joanne said, 1,300, wounded 5,000 in the first hour.
But and these are they people also started in the street. Bringing in these car carriers from Benghazi, and they were loaded with those little trucks. You've seen those trucks with the aircraft guns on the back, anti-aircraft guns, with these bearded Muslims sitting in the, and they just brought off. From where we could see them unloading, hundreds of them.
We could see the port from our window.
They were just brought them in and started unloading them.
Nonstop stream of trucks.
And they took over, they just handed Tripoli to them. They raped women, they took houses, they went into shops and stole gold, they went to the historical museum and took all the Roman ruins. They just gave it to them. They just gave them Tripoli, said, take it over, it's yours. So every couple hundred feet or yards, there was a checkpoint of these bearded, I don't know what you call them, Al-Qaeda radicals. And they took over Tripoli at that time. And we were there stuck in the hotel. That was the same time at the Rixus Hotel. There was a 5-day lockdown. People were locked inside the Rixus Hotel because the Libyan people themselves and the Libyan army were so angry at what was happening. And they blamed the media because the media had been telling all these lies. The media was in the Rixus Hotel. They locked it down. They weren't going to let them out. They were going to kill all the media. And the media that was there, most of it, the majority of it, except 7 different media, the people that we knew that were not, they were alternative media, CNN, the ABC, the CBS, all of them were CIA. All of them.
They were calling in strikes,
NATO strikes
on their phones. They would ask to go to a military location. 30 minutes later, it was bombed. They wanted to go to the cultural center where all the records were kept for the infants because Libya had the highest ranking of prenatal and natal care in the world. And that all those records and everything were in a building. It was a historic building. And the UN representative was there going over all these records and everything. He left, and this is the records were in 2 floors below ground. A bunker buster bomb hit that and destroyed it.
30 minutes after he left.
And
they were using his cell phone in order to do the coordinates. See, so you can triangulate on the cell phone. That's what
exactly.
It's that simple.
Exactly. But we were sitting in the Rexus in the coffee shop and heard a guy behind us that was calling in records. We were sitting with a guy that was from Canada. He was actually Libyan from Canada. And he's facing them. We've got our back to him, and the guy is giving coordinates. And we asked the man, we said, do you hear what these people are saying? He said, yes, they do it all the time. Also, there was a white-haired journalist. He's from England, but works for the New York Times. And one day he was on a rooftop one evening, and he was saying, you know, what needs to happen is somebody needs to put a bullet through Gaddafi's head. That would help the Libyan people more than anything. He's there in Libya, in Tripoli, making that kind of a statement. If that was said in the United States or any place else, he'd be arrested. No, he was absolutely honored. And I cornered him one time and told him he should be ashamed of himself. And, of course, he knew what side he was on. He was on the Zionist paid media side.
Now, there were no Libyan women. There was a big thing. Remember, Hillary Clinton was talking about the rape of the Libyan women by the Libyan soldiers and all this stuff. And we're going to have to go in there with the ground troops because these women are – that's an absolute lie. The lady who came forward said she was raped by the Libyan soldiers was a prostitute. She was set up and paid to do it. The Libyan women were being raped, and we interviewed a number of them. They were being raped by these mercenaries that came in there. They had rape houses inside mosques. They had them around different places in the city. They would kidnap these young women and take them there, take all their clothes from them. And they would have these rape houses. Many of these young women, some of them committed suicide, but there was a group of young women. Misrata was known for having beautiful women, and they kidnapped, I don't know, four or five of these young, beautiful women. They were 13, 14, 15, 16. They cut off their breasts. They raped them. They cut off their breasts, and they wrote nasty words in the streets with their breasts.
What's the point of that? I mean, what kind of
atrocities? Just atrocities to shock people.
Shock the people.
There was a family in Misrata that came home because they were against the war. They were against throwing their government over. They were against anybody who was against was either tortured, killed, put in prison. And these people, one family came to us and they came home. Their son had been chopped up and put in their refrigerator when they opened their refrigerator. These are the kind of atrocities. They were scaring people to death.
This is the CIA. This is what they do. And we saw it. But if you find documents from people in Kosovo, in the Ukraine, in Yemen, all over, these things happen. This is modus operandi. Shock the people.
We were told.
Take away their will to fight.
When the CIA is leading an operation, you always look for people to be chopped up, cut up, because they like using knives. That's one of their deals.
In Syria, you see babies that have been garroted and hanging on fences and their bodies dismembered. One young man in Libya had a pole inserted in his rectum, went all the way through his body and came out his shoulder. He was still alive. They were in the hospital operating on him. They do that all the time. And, they would take black soldiers and insert a AK-47 in their rectum and fire off a round, blow them apart. They chopped them up. They burned bodies. They
took captured soldiers and killed one of the soldiers and chopped it up and made the soldiers eat it. We have the video of it. I mean, you can't believe I don't know how many people even think of these things. We had interviewed a young man who was 17, I think, and he was in the National Guard. He was helping to guard a road that was going into Tunisia. He was just learning to be a National Guard.
And he was taking food to the
soldiers. He was taking food. He wasn't even really working. That place where he was, that car was blown up. He was captured by these radicals. He said they weren't. We interviewed him when he was in the hospital. They finally got him out. I'm surprised he lived because they cut him open while he was. The thing they did to him is unbelievable. They shot him in the leg. They shot him through his eye.
No, they stuck a big knife in his leg.
They stuck a knife in his leg. They shot him through his eye and he lived. And then they cut him open and urinated in him all the time.
They castrated him. They slit him open from stem to stern, urinated on him.
And what offense had he committed?
Nothing. He was black.
He was black, and he was trying to help the Libyans defend their country. He was
Jimmy and Joanne, this is utterly astounding, astonishing, dumbfounding. We have to take a break. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, with my very special guests, Jimmy and Joanne Moriarty. We'll be right back.
can now say with moral certainty and considerable scientific authority that the death of JFK was committed by a meticulously executed conspiracy which was obscured by an extensive cover-up. Murder in Dealey Plaza, edited by James Fetzer, goes to the heart of the JFK assassination. You'll read new and up-to-date information regarding the Secret Service, the Lincoln limousine, the medical evidence, the cover-up, altering the film, framing the patsy, and the silent historians. Also, 16 smoking guns, each one crushing the government's lone assassin scenario. A world-class chronology of November 22, 1963. Chapters by David W. Mantic, Gary Aguilar, Vincent Palomara, Douglas Weldon, Jack White, Ira David Wood III, James H. Fetzer, Doug Horn, and a classic essay by Bertrand Russell. The complete story in the pages of one single book, edited by James H. Fetzer. Read it now. Read it again. You'll use it as a reference. Murder in Dealey Plaza. Available at Amazon.com and major bookstores around the world. It's murder.
Less than 3% of you people read books. Because less than 15% of you read newspapers. Right now, there is a whole, an entire generation that never knew anything that didn't come out of this tube. This tube can make or break presidents, popes, prime ministers. Television is not the truth. Television is a circus, a carnival, a traveling troupe of acrobats, storytellers, dancers, singers, jugglers, sideshow freaks, lion tamers, and football players. We deal in illusions, man. None of it is true. But you people sit there day after day, night after night, all ages, colors, creeds.
Broadcasting live on Network Radio.
So turn off your television sets. Turn them off now. Turn them off and leave them off.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade.
It looks like one of those scenes of an old building being purposely dynamited and blown.
When we are successful,
I'm just a patsy.
And we will be.
You're ready to make to come to the microphone, so we'll listen
up.
A new world order.
So my name's Robbie Parker.
It might have appeared that way, but from my close-up inspection, there's no evidence of a plane having crashed anywhere near the Pentagon.
Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories concerning the attacks of September the 11th.
President Kennedy died at 1 p.m.
Live from the Media Broadcasting Center.
Now say, with moral certainty and considerable scientific authority, that the death of JFK was committed by a meticulously executed conspiracy which was obscured by an extensive cover-up. Murder in Dealey Plaza, edited by James Fetzer, goes to the heart of the JFK assassination. You'll read new and up-to-date information regarding the Secret Service, the Lincoln limousine, the medical evidence, the cover-up, altering the film, framing the patsy, and the silent historians. Also, 16 smoking guns, each one crushing the government's lone assassin scenario. A world-class chronology of November 22, 1963. Chapters by David W. Mantic, Gary Aguilar, Vincent Palomara, Douglas Weldon, Jack White, Ira David Wood III, James H. Fetzer, Doug Horn, and a classic essay by Bertrand Russell. The complete story in the pages of one single book, edited by James H. Fetzer. Read it now. Read it again. You'll use it as a reference. Murder in Dealey Plaza. Available at Amazon.com and major bookstores around the world. It's murder.
With Jimmy and Joanne Moriarty. Please do continue.
Okay. The thing that we'd like to, first of all, I would encourage everybody to go to our website, which is LibyanWarTheTruth.com. And the only way we can support ourselves is by the little DVD that we sell, and it's 3 hours. It's all the information we've talked about. It's all the videos. It's a confirmation that the war was planned in advance, and that's confirmed by Dennis Kucinich. And
you're telling me that that DVD is out and a lot of people have it.
Yes, sir. Yes, yes, sir.
Very important.
That's how we exist.
There's a lot of people all over the world. We've sent a lot of them to Europe and Australia and Canada and a lot of places.
In the thousands, I take it.
Yes. What, we were very successful business people, and actually, when we got back to the United States, we didn't realize it, but we were blacklisted and soft killed by the intelligence agencies because of what we saw in Libya. And we were so slow to realize that. For 2 years after we got back, we continued to provide intelligence on where Al-Qaeda leaders were spending the night, where their weapons stores were.
In the false belief the American people, the government might be attacking them to take them out.
Yeah, and we kept thinking.
In fact, they were going to be defending them and making sure the information didn't fall into the wrong hands.
Exactly. That's what happened. But, you know, we kept thinking, well, gosh, if we can find a good God-fearing politician, we'll tell him how wrong-footed our government is in Libya, and they'll do something about it. And, of course, that never happened. But I'd like to – Joanne was talking about how Tripoli was overrun. And what Joanne and I did is the Libyan government, for all practical purposes, was a burn card. Gaddafi, you couldn't put enough whitewash on him to clean him up.
They've been targeting him forever.
And so what we did is we wanted, of course, to have our business to get back on track, but we also wanted the Libyan people to get their country back. And so we discovered that they had this second house in their government that was made up of the tribes. And the secretary of the tribe was a 200-member bunch, and they had above that a 40-member regional house, and then six above that, and the supreme leader of the tribes. They were the shadow government in Libya. So we said, well, nobody's ever talked about the tribes in Libya. We will go out and do what we can to let the world know that Libya actually has another part of their government that is legitimate and that doesn't have all this negative history. And so Joanne and I went to every tribal meeting we could. And they had, there's 800 tribes in Libya. There was a tribal meeting going on twice a day. Different tribe, different place. So we were there at all these tribal meetings because here's two little white faces. They'd seat us in the very front row and the cameras would always go to us. So we were giving them, we were giving the people in Libya the look of a couple Americans who were out trying to help them. It also was a thorn in the side of the media because when they were showing this tribal event, here's two Americans in there that didn't quite fit their agenda. But we did that for the whole time we were in Tripoli. And the result of that was that we were put on Al-Qaeda's kill list because we had had the audacity to tell Libyan people they should have the right to determine their own government. And, of course, you can't say that. So when Tripoli was overrun, our government never made one effort to help us.
And they knew we were there. My daughter had called the State Department 100 times.
Not any help at all. And so the,
They were probably hoping that you'd be taken out.
Oh, we were supposed to be. But the Russian ambassador called Joanne. He said, listen, there's a rescue ship coming from Malta. And he said, I put your names on the list because that's going to be your only chance to get out. So we said, great. And then we were there in the lobby of the Carinthia, and a blonde, good-looking guy came over, and he had a German accent. He said, are you Americans? We said, yeah. And he said, my name's Tony Hay. I'm the FIFA football, soccer coach here. Are you going to get out of this place? And we said, we're going to try. And he said, can I go with you? We said, okay. So she called the Russian ambassador back and we had another name and he said, yes. And so by the time it was finished, we had seven in our little entourage.
Wow.
The hotel loaned us a van to take us to the rescue ship. And so early one morning, we started trying to get to the rescue ship. And the location, we were being coordinated by a satellite phone connected to the aide of the Prime Minister of Malta. And she didn't know where the ship was. And she kept giving us wrong directions. And we were going up and down the coast from Tripoli east. 40-50 miles, and every 100 yards or so, there'd be another Al Qaeda Muslim Brotherhood checkpoint, and they would stop. And
God, it's a miracle you even survived this trip.
Oh yeah. Oh, listen, it was a tough thing. And the two drivers we had, driver and a shotgun, they would tell the Al Qaeda guys we were reporters, and the report, Allah Akbar, good deal, you know, because the reporters have been lying for them forever. And they'd fire off.
The reporters were all CIA.
Sure. And so up and down, one time a guy got so excited, when he fired his gun off at the ground, the window ricocheted up and knocked out the back window. So, of course, all of us marked our drawers on that. But this was hours and hours back and forth and back and forth. And that in itself is a miracle we didn't get knocked over. But the last time we went back into the – well, let me back up from there. Just before that, they took us into a shipping village. This gal is saying the ship is in a shipping village. It's this name. It's this place. We knew where that was. We went to that shipping village. There was no ship there. We're looking for a big ship. We went to that little village. They took us into an alleyway. And the alleyway was so narrow, you couldn't open the doors on the van. And as we proceed down this long alleyway, we see a bunch of people there, lights. It was a mosque. That's where all the atrocities take place. The CIA goes into the mosques. They use the mosques as the drug distribution center, alcohol, rape houses. They put kettles in there and they boil people after they've tortured them and chopped them up. All the atrocities happen in the mosques. And so here was a mosque and we said, oh hell, we're not going to make it out of this. Well, it turns out those people were real nice folks. They were just there trying to help. And they direct us back to where the fishing area was in their little town. We got back there. We got out of the van. We're looking. We don't find any ship. Well, it turns out that they had sent in two tugboats without their lights on. And we were supposed to know that. It was 50 yards from us, and we never saw it. So we get back in the van. They say, well, it must be at the port of Tripoli. So we went back into the port a second time. That time when we went back in, we were there about an hour. And one of the people with us, a fool that was supposedly a Boy Scout, he was there. He was from Texas, but he was there. We met him that day, actually. He was there trying to sell weapons or do anything he could in Libya. He was a no good Nick, you know. But he had gotten up in the wheelhouse of one of these ships and was talking ship to shore to the rescue ship. Now then, that ship had been taken over by Al Qaeda and Muslim Brotherhood, and they were asking him for the names of everybody that was in the group.
Not the ship, but the guy in the port. The ship was 3 miles out because they had fired on it.
And wouldn't let it come in. So this guy has given them all our names and our IDs and everything. We're there over an hour, and finally, all at once, 20 or 30 of these little trucks with four or five bearded, armed Al Qaeda attack us from all sides. And they, I mean, each one of us has half a dozen AK-47s on us, right in our face. One big tall guy, kind of bald headed, older man. He was probably 45, real hard looking guy. He said, your game's up. We know who you are. We have you on our kill list. And he had a piece of paper with our names on it. So they took us from the port to their torture center. And when we got to the torture center, they kept us downstairs. And this was the
Mahari Hotel.
We stayed in that hotel earlier. It had no electricity, no air conditioning, no water, nothing. But the emergency electricity was working enough for the elevators to work. And constantly they were bringing in wounded soldiers, and they were taking them up the mezzanine area and torturing them. we were hearing sounds coming out of those guys that we'll be haunted by those sounds the rest of our lives. But we're down here, downstairs.
Maybe because they were wounded or because they were being tortured.
They were being tortured.
They were wounded and then they were tortured.
There was a lot of torture going on, but also a lot of executions.
Yeah.
I'm amazed you weren't just shot on the spot when he said you're on our kill list.
Well, we should have been.
But what
he didn't have the right to do that. So they kept bringing in, and this was late at night. This went on, you know, for a day and a half, and this was now every little bit, some higher executives would come in, and they would interrogate us, and they'd point our finger. You knew this guy.
They took our passports. They took everything we had.
You know this guy. You worked with that guy. You know, they kept accusing all of us. And
we were pretty famous in Libya. We've been on TV a number of times. The Libyans told us that it was important for the Libyan people to see us because we were keeping
the Libyan, we're saving the face.
We were saving the face of America for the Libyan people.
And in our group, we had a Bahraini prince.
Let me get that straight. They wanted you out there for propaganda purposes?
They wanted us out there because we were telling the truth of what was happening on the ground.
Yes. But the bad guys, telling the truth.
Oh no, yeah. The bad guys didn't want us there.
No, they were angry
with it. They put us on the kill list.
The secondary benefit was the legitimate Libyans, because the bad guys were not Libyans. They were mercenaries brought in. So the legitimate Libyans said, you know, what you're doing is you're saving the face of the American people for the Libyan people. So that was not anything we had planned to do, but that was a bonus. But anyhow, they're bringing in more high-ranking Al-Qaeda, Muslim Brotherhood all the time to parade us in front of them. They'd bring them in, and they'd look at us.
You're like trophies. You're trophies.
Yeah, exactly.
And, of course, I didn't have enough sense to know how much trouble we were really in, but I kept demanding to get our passports back. I said, my gosh, we're U.S. citizens. We've been helping you all. You know, our government is not going to let you do anything to us. You know, I kept being boisterous about it. And we had a Bahraini prince had asked to go with us. We had the sister of the president of Mauritania was with us. We had a gal that was a IT person from the hotel. We had this FIFA coach from Germany. We had this man from Texas who was a Boy Scout leader, but really
he was the one who was betraying you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so that was the seven of us. And so after a long time, a man that we had known from the Corinthia Hotel spoke perfect English. He was their IT guy, spoke perfect English. Anytime we had problems with the internet or anything, he was always very helpful to fix it, but not friendly. Well, a few Libyans, it was not friendly. Well, he came over to the Mahari, and he told the other driver, he said, you leave, I'm going to drive now. And so he came over, and they were about to give us our passports back and everything, and he took Joanne over to the side.
No, what happened was he said, this van, we said we wanted to go to the rescue ship, and he said, this van is not going to the rescue ship. This van is going back to the hotel. And Jimmy got real angry about that. He said, no, we're going to the rescue ship. That's what we said we were going to do. And we're going to get out of this country. And he was angry. He wasn't listening. So the IT guy, he pulled me off to the side. There was a lot of people in the lobby. They had brought our passports back and told us we could leave. So, he pulled me off to the side and he said, what your husband didn't understand, this imam say, he says, you see that guy over there with the big long white beard? He said, he's an imam. You don't, what he said was, when they go to the rescue ship, there's a kill zone set up two blocks that way on an underpass. We knew right where it was. He said, they're to stop you, kill you, chop you up in burn you, and it'll be blamed on Gaddafi. He said, that's not going to happen because this van is not going that way. It's going the other way.
He said he was saving your life by not going. This is the first miracle. He was Al-Qaeda. And he said, I've gotten to know you all. You're just here trying to help the Libyan people. And he said, I think I'm going to be able to sneak through the back roads and take you back to the Corinthia, get you out of the kill zone. And Joanne said, well, you better tell my husband that because, you know, he doesn't understand that. So he took me over the side. And when he told me the story, I said, we're going back to the Corinthia. No question about it. Somebody tells you that.
When you go that way, you're going to be chopped up and burned.
Right. Yeah.
Wakes you up.
Good idea to take it seriously.
And then he said, we must pay the people that are waiting to kill you, because they're all going to be paid $2,500 a piece to kill you and another $1,000 to chop you up and burn you. Well, of all the people there, Joy and I were the only ones with money. I had $16,000, I think $700 or $800 left. I gave him that money. He went down and negotiated their silence. Now, that didn't mean that we were free, but that meant that they would not say anything about it. And so we'd have some time or days or whatever to try to get out.
We knew we were in trouble because we knew they knew we were there.
That was our first miracle. We got back to Corinthia. Then the next day, the sister of the president of Mauritania, she knew people in Benghazi, and she knew people, one man that was Al-Qaeda, but not really a radical. And he was one of the men that was operating the UN rescue ship. It was a refugee rescue ship going
the IOM ship.
From Tripoli, taking refugees to Benghazi.
Taking immigrants, really.
Yeah.
People have been working there from the Philippines, nurses and stuff, trying to get out of the country.
And she said, I know this man. He knows you. He's seen you in this hotel for some time. And she said, he's promised me that he'll see that we get to Benghazi and then not put on buses going to Egypt, but taken into the city. And I said, Benghazi, my gosh, that's the head of the snake. And she said, no, I've been talking to people over there. All the bad guys are over here killing people in Tripoli. Benghazi's empty. So we came and met with him, and he promised us that he would take us in his van. He would take us through all the stop places, all the interface of Muslim Brotherhood to the pier. He'd get us on the ship. He was good to his word. He took us all the way through there, got us on the ship. That was the second miracle. So we had slipped the news. They didn't yet know that we were not dead. And then we got on that ship. It went to Benghazi. It was two of the worst days you can imagine. This ship was a converted car carrier. Air conditioning didn't work. There were no curtains on the windows or anything.
There
this
was
is
no
in
food.
The,
there was just seats to sit in.
This is in late August in the Mediterranean, southern part of the Mediterranean.
It would have been sweltering.
Oh, yeah.
It was
like
overloaded with people.
Steam bath. It would have been
two bathrooms. And of course the only food on there was some hot water. They were bottled water, out of date fruit juice, moldy bread, and
that was it.
And so when anybody would drink this fruit juice, they immediately were doing the green apple quick step.
Right, you have diarrhea.
A couple hundred people, two bathrooms, so they were hanging off the side of the ship. And then they'd be in the bathroom, they'd try to wash their hands and everything else, you know. So anyhow, we finally get to Benghazi, and sure enough, everybody else, their luggage was loaded into dump trucks, and they were put on buses, and they were taken to the Egyptian border to put in refugee camps where we would have been caught and found out. He had us taken to the hotel called the
Tbilisi
Hotel.
It's the only one in Benghazi.
And so we landed there. We had lost one of our members, the little gal, the Filipino that was a member of the hotel staff, didn't want to have any part of us. We were too dangerous for her. And we got to the hotel, and there was a U.S. consulate in that hotel. There was a European Union consulate in that hotel. So Joanne and I went up to meet the U.S. consulate. The guy didn't even speak English. And he said, I can't help you. I'm here only to help the rebels. And so I'm going too long. We went to the European Union, didn't get any help.
You're doing great. I want to hear the whole story. Go on.
Went downstairs, and by then the concierge had noticed that we weren't the typical radicals that they'd been dealing with for months. And so he called the ranking member of the National Council, who was the phony government stalled by the U.S., and the number three man in that organization was there in Benghazi. And he came over. He sent his security man over first. That guy talked to us. He spoke no English, but found out who we were. They were very impressed. We had a Bahraini prince with us. And then he showed up in a suit and tie. And he said, you're Americans? Yes. How can I help you? And I said, we need to get out of here.
Now, the reason we were okay is because there were no communications between Tripoli and Benghazi. Everything had been blown up or shut down, and so they couldn't talk to each other. If they had been able to talk to each other, that list would have been given out. We would have been captured there.
And proper protocol in Libya is you talk to the man or talk to a person, find out what tribe they're with, see if you know somebody in that tribe. Well, it turns out he was a member of the tribe where our best friends in Libya were, one of the mountain tribes on the west side, and he was a member of that tribe. He knew them. He said, yes, they're not very important, but, you know, we know them. They're very good people and everything. I said, they're our best friends. So that bit of bona fides bought us our lives. And he said, I want to help you. And he said, have you eaten? Well, we hadn't eaten in 4 or 5 days at that time.
It was Ramadan, too.
He said, I'm going to invite you to break fast in the hotel. I can't be here. I must be with my family. I'm going to leave my security man with you. And then he said, I'm going to see that he gets you to the airport. There's a plane leaving, taking wounded soldiers to Tunisia. I'm going to see if he can get you on that plane. We ate for the first time, like I said, in days. His security man stayed with us. He took us to the airport. He got us boarded on the plane. We were taken to the executive lounge to keep us out of the eyesight of the Libyans because there were more people wanting to get on that plane than could get on it.
Now, I think near the end of these slides, if he flips through, there's one picture of our group at the airport.
Chance. Some slides, yeah.
Yeah, near the very end. If you flip through,
that's pictures of Libya before and after,
before
you know.
And after, yeah.
What a catastrophic difference.
Yeah,
just
but anyhow.
Look through them.
No, that's not, that's the.
Yeah, go.
Oh, keep going.
So,
Chance, just keep going through them one at a time.
Anyhow, they got us on the airplane. It was the most raggedy ass worn out 727 you've ever seen. Between your feet, you can see daylight. Most of the doors were missing off of the compartments inside. And when the pilot took off, it rattled and rolled and shook. And he flew at a very low altitude without any lights or anything on. He said, we don't want to be accidentally shot down.
These were happier days when you first got there. Yeah.
And when well, we,
that was, yeah, that was at,
that was one
that's
of the first
the
trial
tribes.
Meetings.
That was in 2011.
And, so when we got to Tunisia, we thought we would then have help from our government. It's still
more chance. Yeah. Keep going.
And, we of course had no money left. The U.S. consulate, when we called them and we said, it was a holiday. It was the 1st of September. It was bankers' holiday in Europe. And,
God,
and the guy said, well, he said, we don't have any, we can't do anything. There's no flights available. You know, what we can do is put you up in a hotel and Tunisia is a resort city. It's actually the biggest U.S. embassy in the world. That's where they train all CIA counter-insurgency groups in Tunisia because it's a nice resort area. But the hotel he was going to put us in was about a $70 taxi ride from where we were. We were within $3 of the airport. And he said, what you have to do is somebody in your family will have to send money and
oh, God.
That's how it's paid. And I said, you know, what do you mean? He said, your family can send money and pay for the tickets and everything. We'll make sure that you can get a flight. And I said, how long will that take? He said, well, this time of the year, maybe a week. That's when we were in the executive lounge at the airport.
This is when we were in the executive lounge. You can see.
Is this your group?
That's our group. That you can see the Bahraini prince. He has the mustache in the back. The German FIFA coach is on his knee right there in front. Fatima Tu is next to me. She's the sister of the president of Mauritania, and the other guy is the Texas guy behind him.
Well, he was the guy who was betraying you.
Yeah. And anyhow,
I can't believe he was still with you at this late.
Well, he wasn't really betraying us as much as he was betraying the Libyans. He was not really betraying us. The guy that actually betrayed us was a reporter, a U.S., an attorney, criminal, triple agent named Franklin Lamb. And we had found out who he was. We set him up, but Joanne and I did a sting operation on him, proved him he was a multiple agent. And he's actually the one that gave our names to Al-Qaeda.
Franklin Lamb?
He lives in Lebanon. He lives with next to Hezbollah.
Bright stories like he's a real good, conscientious guy. Absolutely a slime ball.
We saw two passports he had.
Yeah, he's slime ball. Bad guy. And he's the one that put us on the kill list. It was in his writing, and when I saw it, I recognized his handwriting. When the man first came into Tripoli, he had no money. We helped him. We bought his medicine. We took him to the doctor, paid for the doctor fees for him, helped the guy out. But he's absolutely a slime bag. But anyhow, enough of that. When the people there in Tunisia, they said, well, you know, what is your embassy going to do for you? He said, nothing. They're going to put us in a hotel at $180 a night. They're expecting our family to prepay for that. And plus, we don't have the $70 cab fare to get there. Well, that wasn't of any concern to the U.S. And so one of the people there had a friend bring her some money. She paid for our hotel room. Fatima too did, yeah. And then Joanne's daughter got us flights out the next morning to Rome. And when we got to Rome, we had no money, nothing.
Look who we have there.
John McCain.
That's Chris Stevens in the background.
Yes, it is.
Yep.
And that's Al-Qaeda Muslim Brotherhood.
Chris Stevens.
We got to talk about this photograph.
Well, it's pretty telling.
That's the guy they headed. That was one of the heads of the Transitional National Council.
To the right of McCain, to McCain's right, left, looking at the photograph.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Chris Stevens, tell us about the death of Chris Stevens and what happened in Benghazi.
Okay. Chris Stevens first came to Libya as part of the UN team to remove all the nuclear weapons.
PCIA.
And then, in March of 2011, this is after no-fly zone had been established for weeks, the U.S. via Qatar and Turkey sent in 20,000 shoulder-mounted to air, shoulder-to-air rockets, European-sourced, but 20,000 of them. Now, why would you need those where there had been a no-fly zone established? And Chris Stevens was the broker for those weapons into Libya. Well, in 2012, because it was now known by all the contiguous countries to Libya that those rockets were all the weapons and everything were flowing out of Libya like crazy in the hands of bad guys. And so, Tunisia, Algeria, Egypt, everybody was telling the U.S., you've got to control this. These weapons are flowing out like crazy. It's dangerous to our countries and as well as yours. And so that day when Chris Stevens was killed, he had a dinner meeting with the representative from Turkey. And we know this because the man that was serving dinner to him was one of the spies for the tribes. The tribes have infiltrated everything in Libya because they're trying to get their country back. The discussion at dinner, Chris Stevens was trying to encourage Erdogan to use his influence to get those 20,000 rockets back. The U.S. would pay whatever price they wanted, but they had to get them back. It was a politically volatile situation. And the Turkish...
Which rockets specifically were they?
These are shoulder-to-air rockets.
They're like man-pad rockets.
Well, were these Stinger missiles?
Well, they were like that, but they were European-sourced. The U.S. didn't want their signature on it, so they sourced them through Eastern Bloc countries and everything, you know. They were Eastern European sourced, but they were like Stingers. And so, but 20,000 of them is the important factor.
Yeah, now who had them originally?
The U.S. delivered them to Libya via
the mercenaries that they put into the
via Libya. Qatar and Turkey.
But were they in Benghazi?
Yeah,
they were delivered through Benghazi, and they went from there to Syria and to Yemen and to
Chris Stevens brought in all the weapons for the mercenaries. He was a gun runner, and he also was supplying the Syrian rebels, so-called rebels, they aren't, with mercenaries and with weapons.
So what was there a reversal in policy for him to try to get all these back?
Too much pressure from the world community. And so, of course,
Libya were complaining because they said there's weapons coming out of this country into our country.
But we had a fool as a president. We had a liar as a secretary of state. But they had to succumb to all the pressure. You know,
remind me, when Benghazi went down, was Obama already president?
Sure.
Yeah. Well, that's just what I'm trying to get clear. I mean, it's so much has been going on. Yeah.
2011.
And Hillary was his court secretary of state. Yes, continue. Go on.
2012 okay. was when the guy
So at this dinner meeting, Chris Stevens is begging for these things to come back. And the Turkish representative said no. And so when dinner was finished, he was taken out the front door of that house. It was a mansion. It was not ever a consulate, never had been, never had a U.S. flag on it. Not any car ever had diplomatic plates. It was a safe house.
It was a CIA safe house.
The Turkish representative got the car. He was taken by fast car to the airport. He was put in a military plane. And when he was in Turkish airspace, that's when the attack on Benghazi on that mansion started.
Did the Turks inspire it? If the Turks said no, would they have said this, Christina?
No, it's answer out. It's a it Muslim was, Brotherhood.
It was organized by the then president of Egypt, who was Muslim Brotherhood, who was Obama's buddy and Hillary Clinton's friend. Morsi and his wife had been 30-year friends of the Clintons, and needs to prove it that he organized it, he trained them, etc.
Tell me a little more about Chris Stevens. He wasn't exactly of his own volition seeking to get them back, but because
he had no choice. He was told, go get them back, and so he was trying.
Well, who told him to go get them back? Hillary?
I'm sure Hillary and Obama. You know, he was told.
He was the ambassador, so Hillary would have told him, directed him to get the weapons back.
Yeah. But he was also assassinated because dead men tell no tales.
Yeah. But what I'm trying to get clear is, he was actually acting on behalf of Hillary to get the weapons back because of international pressure that too many weapons were coming out of Libya and they could be traced back to the United States.
Yeah, we have no proof of that, but what we do know is all the countries around Libya had been making demands for over a year to get these rockets and these other weapons back from the radical Islamists. All the countries around Libya were at risk. And so there was so much pressure put on the U.S. that they said, okay, we'll send Chris Stevens over there, we think. And the funny thing about that night, and the reason we know this, again, is because the man that lived right across the street is the son of one of the tribal leaders. He lives in a real nice house. That's a cul-de-sac area, all big houses, big mansions. And he saw everything took place that night. And he told us what went on. He was one of the first people inside that building after they burned it out. Inside the building, he saw him kicking, urinating on a body inside the building. Didn't know who it was because it was dark. When they took him outside, that's when he recognized it was Chris Stevens. He was already dead. He was not alive when he was taken to the hospital. But let me transition back a minute. When this Turkish representative was in the airspace over Turkey, that's when the attack on that mansion started. Now, the thing that was strange about that day, 2 days only in the history since 2011, Ansar al-Sharia was the hired defense for that building. Ansar al-Sharia is Muslim Brotherhood, al-Qaeda, bad guys. And they had always been a full cadre of defense. That day there were three only. The only other time that there were only three defense people at that location was on the anniversary of their revolution.
There's one of the mass graves right there.
Yes.
And so here was three defenders.
And those people have been burned. They may be black, but it looks like they've also been burned.
Maybe so, but most of them. Anyhow, the attack on this consulate was planned way in advance. 5 hours before this ever happened, the place was completely cordoned off. There were trucks set up to block all the entrances into this area for 3 days. And on the day that when the attack started, yes, they may have had some banners, but they had AK-47s strapped over their shoulders. Very, very few banners, lots of AK-47s. And as the eyewitness said, you know, who goes and has a demonstration brandishing AK-47s? He's a legitimate witness because he's the son of one of tribal leaders. He was on Joyce Riley's show with us. We've had him on a couple of radio programs where he tells what happened that night.
This is a document. We were appointed spokespersons for the tribes of Libya.
Because no one in this government would listen to him. But anyhow, that was strange that there was no defense at that location. And it was also strange that when when the CIA compound, which is about 3/4 mile away, well armed, well defended, well protected, full of weapons and everything, when they were ready to go over there and defend that location, they were told to stand down. There was military aircraft. There were drones, armed drones flying over that location at the time it happened. The military said they could fire some rockets on these attackers and scare them off. They were told to stand down. So no defense was ever given. Why would that be? No defense whatsoever. Many, many areas of defense were available. Attacks could have been
well, the tribal leaders, called us when it happened. They said, you know, your embassy's been attacked tonight. The people who attacked it are in this hospital. They're hiding right now. We can give you the coordinates if you want to go take them out. We had no one to call. We had no one to tell. 2 hours later, they said, okay, all those guys that coordinated the attack and killed Chris Stevens have shaved off their beards and put on Western clothes, and they're all headed for Egypt in SUVs.
They're in these three SUVs.
We can give you the cars, the license plate numbers, and everything. Nobody wants to listen, and if we told them, it would be go on the circular file. As the DIA agent told us, all your information is 100% correct. It goes up to the top, and it's thrown away.
That was confirmed to Pete Sessions. Head of DIA confirmed that everything we've ever said about Libya,
the
Congressman Pete Sessions, everything we've ever said is 100% accurate. And yes, we were soft killed, blacklisted, etc. We've had 5 threats on our lives. The last one just expired. We passed the last kill by date, 1st of January this year. We were told that if we didn't shut up, that we wouldn't see 2016.
What we tried to do was pass intelligence. The tribe started contacting us and telling us, we can tell you where their camps are. We can tell you where their weapons are. We can tell you where their leaders spend the night. Please give this to your people. Because like us, they were naive in thinking that the U.S. would want to fight. This is the guy who came into our home a number of times, Eric Maddox.
He's a top interrogator for the DIA. He's since retired.
Yeah,
but he's a bad guy.
Well, I don't think he is. I think he's duped. I think they have white hats and black hats inside these intelligence agencies.
He's the one that told us that the policy in the United States was being set by Muslim Brotherhood. He also said that all translations of Arabic into English are conducted by Muslim Brotherhood in the United States.
In the intelligence agencies.
That's appalling.
Yeah, it is.
Well, it's probably, yeah. You know, Too true to believe.
If you leave that up for a while, they can get our website on it.
Leave it up. Right. Yeah.
Help us live, because we've had all our businesses and everything taken.
Tell us your reaction when Hillary spent 10 hours being interrogated by the Senate.
It was a joke.
Let
me tell you what.
It's
Trey Gowdy is a joke. They're all a joke.
Trey Gowdy knows about us. He has a file on us.
Never was one person interviewed in Libya that was not an employee of the U.S. government. Eyewitness.
They never had any witness that wasn't already canned in the can.
Yeah, exactly.
They didn't have a single honest witness about what happened.
Not one. They know who we are. Trey Gowdy knows who we are. His two biggest financial supporters are shocked that he didn't want to talk to us. They don't want to know the truth because they're all involved in this mess. They all authorize the destruction of Libya because they work for the Zionists. Everyone in Washington, D.C. is bought and paid for. If anybody doesn't believe that, they should ask themselves, what has Washington, D.C. done for the people of the United States? Nothing.
Well, compare the role of the Gaddafi government in relation to Libyans with the role of Washington, D.C. in relation to Americans.
Yeah,
exactly.
You've got a couple politicians that did not sign the agreement that they would, Israel.
No, it was the allegiance to Israel.
Allegiance to Israel.
And everybody goes to Washington, D.C. must sign an allegiance to Israel contract. The only
putting Israel ahead of the United States.
Exactly.
That's right.
The only two that didn't sign it were Ron Paul and Cynthia McKinney.
That's right.
And both of them are not.
Maybe Kucinich?
Cynthia McKinney.
Dennis Kucinich signed it, but he regretted signing it.
I know all about Cynthia. She's a wonderful person.
Yeah, she was in Libya with us.
Dennis was redistricted out of office.
Yes.
His own party took him out. But on our DVD, there's an hour interview with Dennis Kucinich where he talks about the war on Libya being planned in advance. The war games were done in 2010.
It's just awful. Here you have a wonderful culture with a marvelous president and a happy nonviolent, cooperative social society with a wonderful culture. This is a catastrophe.
It is. Let me tell you something else. In the first week of February, 2011, first week of February, 2 weeks before the uprising starts, the United States Department of Defense gave Gaddafi an award as the most, he was the most beneficial help to the United States in his war.
He was greatest the greatest ally the U.S. had in the war against Islamic terror.
That's in February of 2011, and 2 weeks later, he's the sorriest SOB that ever drew a breath.
Well, the United Nations was going to present him with a humanitarian award when NATO came in and took him out.
That's right. Well, you know, we haven't said this, but we had three or four different intelligence agencies in our home because
at our invitation,
we had the DIA, we had the FBI Terrorist Task Force, and we had the CIA. We did not invite the CIA in technically. What happened was Glenn Beck's organization, The Blaze, called us via Tara Dahl, who was Michelle Bachmann's aide, who is a CIA operative. We didn't know that then. But she wanted, what they were after were all our files. That's what they were after.
They want to find out how many war crimes we can document.
She said, The Blaze has heard about you. A man named Joe Weasel would like to talk to you, and they'd like to do a documentary on your story because no one survives having been captured by Al-Qaeda.
They're going to do a two-hour documentary and have us on Glenn Beck's show three times.
So Joe Weasel called me, spoke to me for an hour, and he said, you realize you're in more trouble from this government than you ever were in the hands of Al-Qaeda. And I said, I'm beginning to realize that. And he said, well, we'd like to bring in some security when we come talk to you for you. So in 3 days, they showed up with their three of them from The Blaze, Joe Weasel and two other people from The Blaze, and this woman named Nikki Barakal. She's a CIA agent. She didn't identify herself as such at the time, but we found out later. But we spoke to them for 6 hours. We gave them some documentation.
Was this a scam to get information from you?
Exactly.
And she said, I have to tell you, I've interrogated a lot of people, and you're absolutely the most truthful. She said, I can tell when people are telling the truth. You're absolutely telling the truth. And I'm going to protect you. I'm going to set up private emails with you if you need anything, if you have help. You're now my family, blah, blah, blah.
But it's all a con.
Yeah. Well, as soon as they left, they were supposed to come back in 2 days with their film crew, or 3 days.
2 days.
We never heard from him again. So I called Joe Weasel. I had his mobile number. He didn't answer. And immediately thereafter, I got a call from Nikki Barakal, who said, I'm in charge of this project and I have canceled it. It's my call. She said, I've canceled it because you need to continue talking to intelligence agencies and you need to tell them everything you have. And we're not going to do a documentary. It's not something that I think is necessary or is good or something. She had some reason. And then Jimmy got on the phone and she told him, she said,
what you need to do is you need to forget everything you know about Libya and start your life over or you won't have a life.
Oh, that's real nice.
I said, that sounds like a threat. She raised her voice. She said, you stand down and do exactly what I'm telling you. You won't have a life.
Who the F does she think she is, for God's sake?
When I hung up, I told Joanne, I said, our lives have been threatened. I said, we better start going public because up until that
time, fools,
you're looking at two fools. We're so stupid. We thought we were helping the good guys.
We start
going public. That was May.
2011.
A wise decision.
Well, you know, we met some people in Dallas that have helped us a lot, Activists for Truth, and we've done a lot of presentations for the John Birch Society, for the Tea Parties. And one of them put us in front of Pete Sessions, and we told you Congressman Pete Sessions has confirmed everything. He was forced to talk to us because he was at a little group of his at a gun store. They were going to do some shooting at a gun range. There was a big storm outside, so nobody showed up, only about 5 or 10 people. And the lady.
He couldn't get away from us.
We didn't know, but the lady we were with, he had been trying to catch him for a long time. He finally said, okay, I'll talk to your people. And so when we started telling him what happened to us, he asked me if I had the phone number of the DIA agent that
he said, any of these intelligence guys, can you call any of them?
And so I called the one, DIA agent, Eric Maddox, who gave us the name Kevin Davis, and he answered the phone. And I said, Pete Sessions is here, Congressman, would like to speak to you. And he kind of said, oh, okay. So he said, listen, I'm Congressman Pete Sessions. This is my private number. You call me back in 15 minutes. And Pete said, I did that so he can check and see who I am. So he called back in 15 minutes. And Pete stepped outside and talked to him for half an hour. He came back. He said, okay, he's real. You're real. I need to take some notes. And he took notes of everything we told him.
An hour and a half.
His father had been FBI. And when we started telling him that we tried to restart our business in Kuwait, he said, they killed that. He said, we said, we gave him.
We had a contract with one of the princes in Kuwait, a big contract. They killed it.
Yeah, we had, in fact, we were told later for sure that was true. But we had tribal leaders in Egypt we were working with, and Tara Dahl wanted to go meet them. And he said, I bet some of them got killed, didn't they? And we said, yeah, five of them got killed. And he said, yeah, that's the way they work. So he knew, well, while we were talking to him, he would finish our sentences. He knew.
And he Sessions would finish your sentences.
Yeah. And he said, I'm going to go back to Washington, D.C., and I'm going to talk to the head of the DIA, and I want to know why they did not make you their best friends. Because if you can get information from the tribal leaders on the ground in Libya where these radicals are, why aren't they using you? Why aren't they hiring you? Why aren't they doing something with you? So 10 days went by, and he called
said,
us.
He said, I'll call you in 10 days.
Yeah, and 10 days went by, he called us. And he said, first of all, let me say something to you. He said, and listen to me carefully. He said, everything you told me. He said, I'm going to repeat that. Everything you told me has been confirmed 100%. Because some things he didn't want to say on the phone, I think.
Yeah, I got it, sure.
And he said, but they did tell me, he said, that all the information you gave them, all your intel, all of it was 100%. And they couldn't figure out how two people sitting in the Woodlands, Texas, could pick up a phone and get intel, actionable intel on the ground.
Anywhere in Libya.
Anywhere in Libya and Egypt and other places. He said, you can get that anytime.
He said they've never been able to get inside the tribes. They didn't know how we did it. And Pete Sessions, he said to the head of the DIA, he said, well, why didn't you make these two people your best friend instead of attacking them? And, of course, he had no answer.
During the hearings in Congress?
Because, huh?
Did that occur during the hearings in Congress?
No, this is a long time before that. Long time before that. And, you know, the reason that they didn't make us their best friends is because we're not corruptible. You know, we know right. The truth. We're telling the truth. And those agencies have all threatened to kill us. And, as I said, the last one said we would not make it past, we wouldn't see 2016. So we've passed another kill by a date.
But I'll tell you the reason I think the reason we're still alive is we're an asset. They don't have any inroads to the tribes. I speak to the tribes all the time. And I'm sure they listen to us.
The only way they know what the tribes are doing by listening to us. But, you know, they've done nasty things to us. They planted drugs in our car. We were given a seminar at the John Birch Society in Houston. And, it was, early in the day. We had, it was our friend Jim Drury. You remember the Virginian? We had a little birthday deal with him that day. And then I had the oil changed and, had the tires rotated. And then that night we, had dinner. And then as we were driving back east, we're in deep southeast Texas, the radar detector started going off and it would be 10 miles. And then two cars pull off, another two cars. This went on for 40 miles. And when they finally stopped us, the guy said, I want to look in your car. And I said, no. He went through this rigmarole. He says, if I find drugs on the car, you're arrested and all this stuff. They took the drug dog around the car 15 times. The dog never marked anything. So they went to the back window of the SUV, tapped the window. Finally, about the 15th time, the dog barked. He said, okay, he's marked drugs. You're under arrest. And he and another highway patroller proceeded to try to take the left rear corner of our car apart. And the whole time he had his cell phone in his ear, and after about an hour.
He was being told where they planted the drugs on.
Yeah, exactly. After about an hour, I asked Joanne. They had us on the other side of the bar. It separated about 15 feet. I said, Joanne, can you slip down there and see what he's saying in that phone? And he's saying, I'm there. That's where I am. They were under the car so many times. Their uniforms were black. 2 hours and a half, they looked mainly in that one section of the car, didn't find anything. Well, the only thing we can think what happened is when we had the oil changed at Walmart, the guy had tattoos on the back of both his hands all the way up his arms. And when he had that thing up on the rack, he probably saw a red tag underneath that left rear fender or someplace. And he said, well, I wonder what this is. And so he had a nice early Christmas present.
All right. Now, listen to me. We only have 5 minutes left. I need your distilled concentration about Hillary's performance before the Benghazi committee.
Okay, it was absolutely a fluff presentation. She never disclosed anything. She lied about all the things that that were there. There was no video that caused this uprising. What she did was lie, and she was really given a pass by Congress. And not only that, but, you know, she has continued to lie. She lied to the families of the victims in Benghazi. Now she's calling them liars.
Joanne, say it.
Her story about Libya is so construed. It's not true, any of it. She tried to say that the Libyan people wanted this, the Libyan people wanted that. She is making her story their story, and it's not true. The Libyan people cannot stand her. She is an absolute war criminal. She has more blood on her hands for Libya than you can even imagine. The same goes for Marco Rubio when he stood up at the debate and said Gaddafi was going to go down either way because of the atrocities he did. What was he saying? Gaddafi was going to go down either way? What did he mean? He knew the plan. He knew the plan. He was talking about the plan that they were going to kill Gaddafi one way or another.
So, you know, Hillary Clinton is just the worst possible person that could ever think about running for office. It's so in your face that the U.S. people could not have a better selection. And it breaks our heart. You know, we've had our country taken away from us. We have no country. We were on a no-fly list.
We've been
had everything taken from us.
Our attorney quit, and he said, you need to go find sanctuary in another country.
But, you know, we're not politically important.
In other words, he'd been subjected to so many threats himself for representing you. He realized you were the real targets.
That's right.
He was getting out of it to save his own skin, and he was advising you to do the same.
That's exactly right.
But, you know, the people need to really take a hard look. There's plenty of evidence out there. Go do your own investigations. Go see and hear the truth. Go to our website.
Your DVD is all over the world, right?
Yes, sir.
Yep.
I submit to you that's the reason you're alive today.
Yeah.
That's
correct. Hillary Clinton's past, if you look at her past, she was fired by the Democratic Committee when they were investigating Nixon for lying and subordinating the truth and doing all kinds of stuff, changing records. She was fired by the Democrats. This is a continued pattern of hers. Only she's gone to the huge depths now of killing people and countries and babies, and it's just
she made a statement in France during one of the meetings that was right after Gaddafi had been killed, and one of the ambassadors asked her, said, well, what about all these innocent people in Libya that were killed? We're hearing numbers of 600,000 or more. And she said, you know, you have to break a few eggs to make an omelet. And he was so shocked. He said, how could a person be so flippant about that many souls?
The mantra of the New World Order cabal is acceptable collateral damage. And as far as I'm concerned, they are the acceptable collateral damage. They need to all be gone. But that's what they say about anybody who dies. Well, we had to do that. That was acceptable collateral damage for our agenda.
We want your folks to keep us in their prayers because we're alive by the intervention of God in our lives. And buy our DVD. We need support. That's the only way we're able to live. We've had everything taken from us. Go to our website.
It's right there.
Yeah, eyewitnesslibya@gmail.com.
That's our
the website is www.libyanwarthetruth.com.
That's right. Correct.
Well, I can't thank you too enough. You've been through a harrowing experience, and you have, by the grace of, I'm an agnostic myself, but it has to be the grace of God that you are here now and the DVD. And I say good luck with everything. You've been fantastic. I can't thank you enough on behalf of the American people. We are enormously in your debt for getting some truth and insight about what happened in Libya, one of the great calamities of modern times.
Yeah, it continues, Jim, today. I get information all the time. It's continuing to this day.
We've been effective. We've got 17 Muslim Brotherhood executives, five of them on death row, the other lifetime sentences for being U.S. spies. We've had a lot of documents read in the Library of Congress. Jerome Corsi's written 40 articles based on evidence we've given him. So we're getting our story out, you know, but God bless the Libyan people. They need your help. And it's a travesty what our country has done.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host, thanking my special guests, Jimmy and Joanne Moriarty, for being here. You are wonderful people. I cannot thank you enough. And to all of you for watching.
Thank you, Jim.